Good evening. You're listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain in Bella Vista. And this is Jim Dowling. And you are listening to Right Stuff. Tonight, my guest is Jim Strope. We know Jim Strope here at KKRN because he's given us some fine radio drama scripts, Director's Cut, which we produced a while back, and Will They Let It Burn? But Jim's got a book out now called The Scornful Society. And it's a no holds barred look at the consequences of a concentration of power and wealth in very few hands in this country and in Western civilization in general. Jim, you want to tell us a little bit about the book?
Yes. Yes. Well, this is a book that, well, I mean, I suppose almost everybody I know have gone through in their life have gone through several transformations on how they see the world. What the basis for the seeing the world and talking about it and like that? Almost personal revolutions, really. Mm-hmm. It's people I talk to, it's a very common experience. And I've had multiple of those.
Right.
Yeah. So I think what triggered it was I was meeting with a group of three friends, two of whom I'd known for decades. And I made a statement that I could really support in terms of a strong evidence, you know, overwhelming evidence and strong logic. I immediately got shouted down.
For what? What was the point you were making that they rejected?
I'd rather delay that for a time.
Okay.
Because
okay.
It was a strong statement.
Sure.
It seemed to me not just an opinion, but a reasoned opinion with evidence and logic, and strong logic and overwhelming evidence. But these were my friends, right? So, you know, what's going on here? So I at that point, I decided that two things. One is that there's a great division, and it came slamming right down, right in front of me, between me and my friends, yeah? And also said to me that electoral politics, elections in the United States are irrelevant. They don't matter.
Okay.
That there is no difference in, say, the foreign policy between the Republicans and the Democrats. You see a great deal of equivalence between what the Republican candidate says, say, about Gaza. No difference between what the Republican candidate says about Gaza, the war in Gaza, the war against the Palestinians, mm-hmm. and what the Democrats say. Same thing with the war against the Russian Federation. So that doesn't matter. And so like this is 50 years ago now, I was a conscientious objector to all wars.
Sure.
Yeah, and this was during the Vietnam War when I saw the thick layer of misinformation applied to it that recruited people into the, you know, working for the war, joining the war, apologizing for the war. But they were, it was misinformation, disinformation, deliberately done, propaganda. So anyway, I decided that this is where my work is going to be. Is working on that level. And so The Scornful Society came immediately out of that.
You've done a lot of research to back up.
Yeah, yeah. So there's over 60 endnotes in the book. So they're not my opinions. They are, they're the result of the research. Yeah.
Well, why don't you share with us some of the conclusions that help explain the condition that you describe in the book?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, to me, it's always about the construction of the citizen subject. A citizen has rights, a subject to the authority.
Okay.
So we have both kinds of people being constructed in our society. And it begins with construction. So as an infant, you're physically constructed by the food that you're given.
Sure.
Right? Your language, by the time you're 9 months to a year, your language is constructed by those who are talking to you. So I grew up in an English-speaking family, and I speaking English all my life. So that's how that works. So that's the construction phase of the citizen subject. In some cases, the citizen In some cases, the citizen is autonomous. That is to say, they have the right of free speech, the right of assembly, things that are guaranteed in the Constitution. That's a citizen. But other people are subjects. That is to say, they are subject to a hierarchy on top of them, and they in turn can look below them, geometrically, look below them, and they can order people below them, around.
Kind of a pecking order.
A pecking order. But those citizen subject, and I make them into a hyphenated word, citizen subject, and they're both constructed like that. And so by the time you're I have a couple of instances when I was 9 years old where I was divided. I didn't know what was going on in the world. Two instances where I was divided against a people, an entire people. Yeah. And so this was how I started the book up. I thought I could explain everything with division. We're divided. And obviously to me anyway, that we are greatly divided in the United States today.
Oh, there's no question about that.
Yeah. And my mom, who's 97, she's, I've never seen it like this.
Right.
She lived through the Depression. She lived through World War II.
Sure.
We are deeply divided, so divided that my friends shouted me down if I dared to say the wrong thing,
the
thing that was not approved. Yeah. We're talking, you asked me about the elements of the, really the construction of those citizen subject.
Right.
So there's construction, and then there's division. So for division, so when I was 9, I encountered my first examples of division.
Okay.
So this is during the election of the campaign season for 1956 for president, the incumbent Eisenhower. I remember Eisenhower.
Yeah.
And he was running against Adlai Stevenson. I didn't know anything about this stuff, but somebody in my family said, "Oh, Adlai Stevenson." You know. So I don't know where they got their information, but I. You know, that was a divisive moment for me. I don't know who these people were, but now I'm looking around for who was this Adlai Stevenson, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Second one, this is one of my friends that lived in a neighborhood about my age, and he had this limerick. So it was like, it goes like, this is divisive. This is going to divide me from people or groups of people.
Sure.
Yeah. And so it was, whistle while you work. Hitler was a jerk. Mussolini bit my weenie. Now it does not work. So ridicule is divisive. When you ridicule somebody, especially if you don't even know them, right? It's not really criticism. It's an attack. Two examples. When I was 9 years old. That's when I first began to, and I didn't realize I was being divided. I was just being divided because it's really a constructive event. It's who I am becoming. Yeah. So it's not like an analytic. It's nothing analytic. It's all reactionary.
Okay.
Construct reactionary. And then the third thing, there's construction, division, and the third thing is coercion. For those who fail to be constructed and who fail to be divided, there is coercion and the threat of coercion. So that's why we have prisons. That's why I was punished for saying something from friends I had known for decades. Coercion is the third step.
So what is the goal of these three?
What was the, sorry?
The goal of the coercion, the goal
of
the division.
The coercion is to contain, it's really to turn the citizen subject, the divided citizen subject, into a criminal revolutionary in the extreme.
Okay.
And I say, I hyphenate that because criminals are considered revolutionaries, and revolutionaries are considered criminals. So criminal revolutionary, hyphenated word. So yeah, the purpose is always the construction of the citizen subject. Construction, division, and coercion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I think your book is about is who is pulling the strings. Who is behind all of this?
This is very important because, and this is what's come to me to be the illusion of elections, the illusion of choice in there, because all of the presidential candidates, all of the candidates for Congress, all of the candidates for governor and their state legislatures, and all of the candidates for at least the larger cities, and even some of the smaller cities, are all selected in primaries with money by the billionaires.
Okay.
That's what's happening. And have tacitly, all of these candidates have signed on to working for the billionaires, yeah, while dividing the public. So they're doing two things. They're splitting the public into two more or less equal camps, and they are also writing legislation to promote the business of the billionaires, especially, well, not especially, but including the defense industry, okay, the war industry.
All right.
The murder, international murder industry.
So politics and business are part of the same power structure?
This comes from Mussolini. Okay, when later on, after I heard that limerick, I eventually began to learn about Mussolini. Yeah, and Mussolini said that fascism, and he should know, he founded the Fascist Party of Italy, right? Fascism is the combination of business and government, that they become brothers.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's fascism. I think we've even gone beyond that, because now government actually, not a partner of business, government is a servant of business, because the billionaires in the primaries with their money select the candidate. Republican, they select the Republican, and they select the Democrat, and both of them work for the billionaires, for the benefit of billionaires.
Okay.
I'm calling this democratic fascism. So we have a choice between two fascists.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You mentioned the great die-off.
Uh-huh.
Why don't you lead up to that, a little background?
This is the most outrageous thing.
Okay.
Happening. In the book, I have, in the introduction, I have about 12 complaints, you know, that I have, and that people have, that we have, you know. And the last one is what biologists have been predicting for decades. That is, there is going to be not a great die-off so much, but there's going to be an extinction, more and more, of wild animals and wild plants. So I have this paper. It's on my Facebook page. It's Jim Strope. And you can see there's both the YouTube and there's also the paper itself, which you need to be willing to look at numbers and charts and things like that. But anyway, the gist of it is that by 2070, large parts of the planet are going to become unlivable for plants or animals. So that includes the greater Amazon basin, not just Brazil, but some of the Peru, the eastern Peru, Venezuela, also much greater part of northern Africa, a much greater part of India, and many of those rainforest islands of Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, all those things. There is going to be a great die-off between now. It's already started. You can already see it. But by 2070, they estimate that 1 to 3 billion people are going to have to move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
their
climate is so hot, they can't.
Well,
survive.
They can't grow vegetables there.
Right.
Nor can they grow animals there.
Okay.
Because they have to feed the animals.
Yep.
And in fact, it becomes very difficult for them to live in these areas.
So what is the ripple effect? You've got all these people that need to move.
Well,
what happens?
You can see what's going. You can see this already happening is the migration out of Latin America. Part of that's climate. The other part of it is the political chaos in these countries, which I submit often is caused by the United States government doing covert operations, interfering with elections, civil wars, revolutions, coup d'etat, and like that, which destabilizes these countries. And so people are just, you know, they're at a loss of what to do, so they're trying to leave. And you can see what happens at the American border, right? Yeah. That this is not, they're not welcome, they're not being welcomed here. In fact, both presidential candidates are closing down the border. Both of them.
Yeah.
Both of them. You can also see what's going on in Africa. People are trying to get across the Mediterranean to any place they can.
Yep.
They're not welcome there. Hundreds of thousands of people have tried to leave Syria, the chaos in Syria, which the bombing of Syria started during the so-called Arab Spring by Barack Obama that destabilized that country. And it's just continual chaos in Syria. So, and you can see that these folks are not welcome. And that's maybe, I don't know what the numbers are, a million or two people a year is not acceptable. 1 billion a year on the best case. That's not 1 billion a year, but 1 billion between now and 2070. That's 20 million a year, 20 times the migration rate it is right now.
Yeah. So the problems that we are seeing in 2024 are minuscule compared to what's up ahead, apparently.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So you're looking at a huge migration because of the band of deserts mm-hmm. and the northern hemisphere that includes American Southwest, northern Africa, Saudi Arabia, northern India. That band of deserts is going to get bigger.
Sure.
That's the climate, you know.
Okay. Well, some people listening are going to go, but where did Strope get his information?
Yeah, so this is on my Facebook page again. There is there's a fellow named Tim Fenton. He's a senior client scientist, and he, with seven or eight other people, is listed in the paper. So there's a copy of the paper. It's a scholarly paper with footnotes where he gets his information.
Sure.
And then there's also a YouTube presentation with two other senior client scientists. I don't think they're the ones that were involved in the paper, but they have the same scenario.
Sure. I just thought I'd throw that out there. I mean,
yeah.
I'm a firm believer that the climate is changing. And
yeah, on my Facebook page, Jim Strope, okay. And then it's a paper and a YouTube presentation on climate risks.
What's the solution?
The solution,
what can we do about this?
The solution, of course, has nothing to do with electoral politics, because what they do is try to distract and diffuse the criticism, and they blame it on each other. Oh, actually, they don't talk about global warming, for example. I don't hear anything about global warming coming from either of the presidential candidates. So they ignore the most important thing, the most scandalous thing of the dozen or so points that I bring up. This is the worst thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's almost a guarantee that we're not going to see radical improvement in the next few years.
Not from elections, not from party politics. They are there to get in the way of change. That's what they do. So I propose a nonviolent revolution. This is my solution, not just my solution, but it arises from almost every person's personal revolution, personal transformation, and the way that they have all historically in their own lives seen through advertising, right? Because political campaigns are advertising campaigns. They use the same tactics that they use for selling soft drinks or cars or houses or wars. It's very, you look at it and analyze it in those terms, you'll see it.
Sure.
Yeah. And so a nonviolent revolution, that's what I'm proposing. And this is on the back, this is in the introductory chapter, and it's also on the back cover of the book, and I'm calling for well-targeted boycotts. This is something everybody can do, switching brands. Instead of buying this, buy that. Everybody spends all their money. Yeah, pretty much, unless you're a billionaire. Yeah.
So hit the opposition in the wallet economically.
That's right. Well, hit the bill. You're hitting the billionaires. That's what you're doing. You're hitting the billionaires. And then in addition to boycotting demonstrations, demonstrations are a way of getting away from the news programs on TV or wherever you're getting them. You know, it's really, you now begin to walk and talk with other people.
Okay.
And instead of making up your mind beforehand and seeing it confirmed in some way on TV, no, you go to at least one demonstration. You haven't been to a demonstration in a few years, do it again. Walk with them, talk with them, get to know them, find out that how diverse they really are.
Sure.
Not whether they believe what you believe, but the diversity of opinions and also the possibility of unity. So well-targeted boycotts. It can't be just like I get mad at some waiter someplace and therefore I'm going to boycott the place. No, that's not it. It's well-targeted boycotts. And I don't know what they are exactly. I would look to the BDS movement. They have a web presence. And so that would be a place to start. Yeah. So well-targeted boycotts, demonstrations in the street, and strikes. Strikes, of course, the most expensive, because to engage in a strike, you got to take time off work. So that's the most expensive. Boycotting is probably the cheapest thing you could do. That is to say, the least expensive thing you could do, because it's a question of switching brand, I believe. This is the well-targeted part of it. So I'm not aware what these targets should be or are. And then going to a demonstration, okay, you got to get in the car or public transportation and go to it, and you're going to take some time. So that's like the middle portion of it. But if you consider all three of those things and take them seriously and pursue them, I believe this will have a large impact.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, one of the points you make in your book is the concentration of power with ultra-wealthy people.
Uh-huh.
And you talk a little bit about history, the history of the United States and foreign affairs.
Yeah.
So how did things evolve to where they are today?
Well, yeah. So I've thought a lot about this, and I've written about this in the book. So, and particularly in the introduction chapter, it really starts with the destruction of the culture of Native American Indians. Started really early. There was a King Philip's War in 1676. This is where the Indians of the Northeast were exhausted from having their game.
Sure. Decimated.
First of all,
yeah.
Their game was being killed out from underneath them, so they were hungry. And so King Philip, that was the American's name for an Indian chief who, like Tecumseh, had organized many different tribes of Indians, and they counterattacked. It was a war, and they naturally killed people, but also just as naturally, they eventually lost. King Philip's War. There's also Bacon's Rebellion. This was in Virginia, around Jamestown. I think that was about the same time, in the 17th century as well. Bacon's Rebellion. Check it out. And I don't know. This is examples of that. Of course, we've seen in American history where this process continued from the East Coast all the way through the Midwest, over the Rockies and into California, where Native American Indian culture has been destroyed. Languages are lost, religions are lost, the individuality of the tribes, and certainly the individuality of almost every particular Native American Indian. So it was a continuous process. And it's deliberate. It's not a mistake. It was American domestic policy as the empire, American empire, grew from coast to coast.
Okay.
Reading about the Missouri Indians, they lived at the intersection of the Missouri River and the Mississippi. They were in rebellion after the Civil War. And it was after the Civil War when the American military really began to, not began to, but accelerated the process of destruction of Native American culture. So Custer was one of these. Sure. Called the squaw killer by the Indians. Yeah, he would ride into him and the seven cavalry would ride into an Indian village with pistols and sabers and just shoot everybody they could, and that would scatter. People would run away, and so that would really disrupt the village life, you know.
Absolutely.
Coming back together.
So by extension, moving into modern times, I think one of the points you make is this model still exists with other countries.
Yeah.
In our foreign policy.
Yeah. Well, it's settler colonialism is what it is. This is the British thing. I was just recently reading about the history of Northern Ireland, of Ulster, you know. They colonized it. They drove out the Irish earls, called the Flight of the Earls. And they were driven out of Northern Ireland and replaced by English and got Irish.
Okay.
Yeah, and they were called undertakers because they had a contract to undertake the colonization, and they would get some amount of land. The more land you got, the more responsibility you had.
We are starting to run a little short of time, so maybe we can get you... Would you like to read an excerpt from your book?
Sure.
If we could pick one?
I think this will cover it right here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And I'm not going to read the whole thing. There's just some points in here.
Sure. Just tell us what you're going to read and then go for it.
Yeah, okay. This is from The Scornful Society, which is available... It's available on Amazon. You can get it directly from Lulu.com. That's the publisher. And this is the opening chapter, and it's called The Necessity of Revolution. That is to say, it is the necessity of getting beyond party politics in the United States, because we are number one in terms of what we're talking about here, the necessity of revolution. And the revolution I propose is nonviolent. Yeah. So it's called The Necessity of Revolution, and the government creates a revolutionary situation when it treats the people as its enemy. I think this is a fundamental principle. So the U.S. government deindustrialized the country, losing half our manufacturing jobs while our population doubled and offering no compensation to generations of unemployed. This has gone on since 1975. 1975 was around the peak of our industrial capacity. And since then, there are various things that have gone on that the government has approved. Well, it's been driven by the billionaires, because this is where they save money, is by minimizing jobs. So again, it's always driven by the billionaires, and then it percolates down through the parties into division and distraction and things like that. So we've lost half our manufacturing jobs since 1975, while our population has doubled. That means coming out of high school, your chances of getting a job at all are like one-fourth as they were in 1975. And you're likely to be working for less.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. This has been a great discussion, and I appreciate you coming in, Jim.
Yeah.
Jim Strope's been sharing with us his book, A Scornful Society, a very thought-provoking book, and thank you for coming in, Jim.
Well, it's a pleasure. I was wrote the book, and now I'm on KKRN.
There you go.
Yeah.
You're famous.
I'm getting there.
Okay. You've been listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain in Bella Vista, and I'm going to give you the usual spiel. If you want to help us out, go to kkrn.org and hit that donate button, because we depend on you, the listener. Thank you so much, and have a good evening.